Are you ready to proceed? Mr. Bernstein, good afternoon.
Justice Holland, Justice Ridgely, Justice Berger, good afternoon. My name is Joseph Bernstein. I'm here representing Glenn McDonald, who is appealing the denial of a motion for post-conviction relief. My plan was to try and touch on each of the issues that I raised in the brief. However, obviously, if the court is more interested in one particular issue than another issue, as I'm sure you will, feel free to interrupt me, and I'll try to address that. But in any event, I'd like to start out with the issue that was raised concerning the appellant counsel in Mr. McDonald's direct appeal, failure to pursue the issue about the admissibility of the of being forced to turn over the interview that Mr. McDonald's first trial attorney had with Mr. McDonald's mother. And the Superior Court below in the Rule 61 ruled against us on that point and basically said it really, the issues that were raised in the appeal were better. You don't have to raise everything possible, and basically characterized this as a strategic decision not to argue this issue.
And but, I would take but the Superior Court also said, assuming it was an error, that the Superior Court thought it was harmless because it was cumulative or duplicative of other evidence. Now, I know in your brief you said because it was Mr. McDonald's mother, it was significantly different. But the Superior Court did say both things, didn't it?
Well, yes, that was an alternate holding, I agree. And I can address that briefly. The testimony that the court was referring to was not as detailed. Didn't come from the defendant's mother, which I think is very significant because from the jury's standpoint, when the jury sees the prosecution put in evidence from the defendant's own mother that the state believes is incriminating, they're certainly going to pay more attention to that kind of evidence and to just about any other kind of evidence that you can think of. So I would respectfully disagree with the trial court's judgment that it may have been cumulative in the sense that it may have been the same generic type of evidence, but was it more prejudicial? Absolutely so. And I can touch on the merits here just very briefly. I have an issue that was hotly contested in the trial court. There was a case that was arguably contra to the trial court's ruling, a Pennell case, that basically cut the state off at the pass and said, no, you can't use the Attorney General's subpoena power to get something you can't get under Rule 16. And the trial court in this case ruled just the opposite. So you have conflicting decisions, no definitive ruling from the Delaware Supreme Court about does Rule 16 trump the state subpoena power or vice versa? And in my opinion, this was a good issue. It was better than certainly the plain error Doyle issue that was raised in the direct appeal. It was better than the other peripheral issues that were raised in the appeal. And when you talk about, well, sometimes it's better to narrow your arguments and winnow them down. Here we have a first-degree murder case. It wasn't a capital case, but it was someone who was looking at the prospect of spending the rest of their life in jail, who had a live issue that there was no clear guidance from this court. And in my opinion as an appellate counsel, that's the kind of issue you want to bring to the court. The second issue we raised really had to do with statements by one of the witnesses and a detective which recounted that witness's statement having to do with statements about, I'm afraid of McDonald. There was no objection to what I'm going to call fear statements at trial, and these statements came in. And as I'm sure the court is very familiar with the rule that this court approved in the Porter case, that was somewhat modified, I think, by Capano, although I can't claim authorship of that particular argument. But the risk when you allow statements like, I'm afraid of McDonald, I don't want to be with him, and statements of the like, is that the jury, as the court said in Porter, is going to imply that there's some valid reason for this fear and use that against the defendant. Now, this court has approved the use of those statements in rebuttal where the defense raises accident or self-defense or defenses of that like. But the rules at least seem to be clear that statements about fear of the defendant were not admissible case in chief. And that is the second argument that we raise, is that the trial attorneys didn't object to this, just let it in. Well, the third issue has to do with the trial attorney's failure to call two witnesses, Thomas Davis. Mr. Davis testified in Mr. McDonald's first trial, was available, and basically put Mr. McDonald at home during the relevant time period when victim in this case disappeared. The second witness who wasn't called at trial, and she was not called at the first trial, was an individual named Wendy Mazza. Miss Mazza was the girlfriend or former girlfriend of an individual named Al Smith. And Al Smith was significant because Mr. McDonald, in his trial, essentially, he took the stand and put the blame for the killing on Mr. Smith.
Blamed McDonald. So.
Yes.
Now, as I understand the Superior Court's ruling on not calling these two witnesses, Superior Court determined that the witnesses that were called accomplished whatever purpose would have been served by these two witnesses. Is that the ruling?
The ruling was that it wasn't ineffective assistance to counsel because the same kind of evidence came out through other witnesses. And especially Wendy Mazza, she's Al Smith's girlfriend. And the interview that she gave to the attorneys would have been very, if no matter what she said on the stand, whether even if she was a turncoat witness, her out-of-court statement comes in. And it was very damaging to Al Smith and very incriminating to Al Smith. And, again, I guess I disagree with the trial court's judgment that this was just kind of icing on the cake. I would describe it more as the cake rather than the icing. So, again, we disagree with the trial court here and say that, and there really wasn't any explanation from the trial counsel at the evidentiary hearing to indicate why they didn't call these people or that they even knew about them. And that's also somewhat troubling. The fourth issue that I want to discuss has to do with Mr. McDonald's decision to testify in a second trial. He did not testify in his first trial, and the evidence produced at the evidentiary hearing on this Rule 61 motion, the defense lawyers were consistent in saying McDonald was kind of on the fence. He didn't know whether he should testify or not testify. He relied a lot on the advice of his counsel to make that decision. And one of the things he was concerned about was this. Well, if I testify, and I testify along the lines that I went over to Smith's house, and he asked me to help him move the victim's car to a shopping center parking lot. He looked very distraught. Aren't I going to get cross-examined about why didn't I tell the police that when I was interviewed by them several times in the days after Julie Spencer's disappearance? And the response from the attorneys was, well, don't worry about that. It's not going to happen. Well, obviously, it did happen. And
can you help me understand on this subject area? One lawyer was of the view should testify. Another lawyer was of the view should not testify.
The lawyers were split.
Okay. So when the lawyers are split like that, and you're arguing that one, I guess, is ineffective and the other is effective, how do we get that out?
It's funny because obviously the decision whether or not to testify is one of those decisions that's not made by the lawyers. It's made by the client. And the client obviously has to rely to some extent on the attorney's advice. Here he was getting conflicting advice. One lawyer saying, don't testify. The other lawyer saying, I think you should testify.
Thought it was more than that. I thought that with regard to the lawyer who advocated testifying, there was a statement to the effect, if something happens, I'll object. And then as the cross-examination transpired, there was an objection for one issue, but not ultimately what he wound up getting cross-examined on. And as I understand it, McDonald's saying he didn't think they would get into anything, so he was surprised that this representation about objecting didn't cover what happened to him. Is that
I think correct? That's a fair statement, yes. If McDonald was relying on counsel's advice and asking questions and getting answers that weren't good answers, I would suggest that his concerns and the response of the lawyers to his concerns that were incorrect played a role in his decision to testify or not testify. And that's how it gets back to, even though it's the client's call, ultimately, to testify or not testify, in this case, it was strongly influenced by bad advice. You won't get cross-examined about that, but he did. And the cross-examination was devastating.
Bad advice from one of them.
On that point. I'm sorry?
Bad advice from one of the lawyers. Good advice from the other one.
Well, 20/20 hindsight, in cases, I suppose, like this, where it's a second trial and the defendant didn't testify in the first trial, there's a lot going on. And it always comes down to, and at least in my experience, they're close calls. But I think in this particular case, it's unusual when the client and the lawyers agree that what his concerns were. It wasn't like, well, he didn't tell us about that. They knew about it. And ultimately, he got bad advice. And that's the issue that we are raising here in this appeal.
The specific bad advice that you're referring to is the generic advice to testify?
Well, no. The bad advice was, I've got concerns about being cross-examined on these subjects, and the bad advice was, don't worry about it. It's not going to happen. If it does, we'll object. And presumably win the objection. So that was the bad advice, not the decision to testify or not testify. But our position is that the advice played a significant role because that was the only concern it expressed. I'm going to save 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
You're getting close to your 5 minutes. Do you want to save the rest of the time?
5 minutes, 11 seconds.
All right. Good afternoon, Ms. McFarland. How are you?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. May it please the Court. Elizabeth McFarland on behalf of the State. In this case, we are in post-conviction, all claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. The State contends that Mr. McDonald cannot establish any ineffective assistance in terms of either his appellate counsel or his trial counsel. As to argument one concerning the prior interview with Mr. Benson that Mrs. McDonald went through, the State contends that it's really decided ultimately on no prejudice.
But is the State exercising its subpoena power in this way on a regular basis?
No. This is a very unique situation given the procedural posture of this case. The Mrs. McDonald was interviewed by Mr. Benson prior to the first trial. And during the first trial, Mrs. McDonald was called to testify. She testified, and Mr. Benson provided a redacted copy of that interview to prosecutors as required in terms of Jenks material. And that had been redacted by Mr. Benson. Prosecutors wanted, naturally, to see the entire interview, not the redacted version by Mr. Benson. The court looked at that interview unredacted, in camera, and determined that there were some parts that should not have been redacted, and the court took it upon itself to redact that interview and then inform Mr. Benson, all right, here's the court's redacted version that you need to turn over to the State. Mr. Benson did not want to do that, and the court struck Mrs. McDonald's testimony as a result. So after the mistrial, the first time, the prosecutors were in possession of the, I'll call it, first redacted copy that Mr. Benson had provided. So prosecutors were aware that there was a prior statement of Mrs. McDonald's. In light of that, they subpoenaed, so they had some sense of what might have been in that prior statement. They subpoenaed Mrs. McDonald to be interviewed, and they also subpoenaed, in light of her interview where she could not remember a lot of the things that she had said to Mr. Benson.
Remind me why you think she's covered by the holding in Jenks.
Well, Rule 26, where you have to provide prior statements, excuse me, and...
Well, I know the rule. I'm talking about the Jenks case.
Well, when you... in order to allow the other side to, it goes both ways. We provide prior statements when a witness is called after the direct. So that was why it was originally produced. So at that point, after the State requested subpoenaed the entire statement, at that point, Mrs. McDonald had not been listed as a defense witness. The State planned to call her as their witness, and it was simply trying to obtain documentation they knew existed from a third party to utilize for their own witness. As such, it was a proper use of the AG's subpoena power. There was no privilege. There was no reason not to provide that, and the court found that was correct, and that in terms of timing, it made sense that if the State's witness...
Well, setting aside the issue of AG's subpoena power, if a trial subpoena had issued, would that have gathered the same information? Dukas Tecum produce...
I would think so. So in any case, that... only a very limited portion of that statement was ultimately used at trial, and that the portion that was used was the portion that was the same information that Mr. Wiley had testified to, and the state would respectfully disagree with defense counsel's representation that Mr. Wiley's testimony was not as detailed. It was, in fact, pretty well detailed. And as such, Mrs. McDonald's testimony really became cumulative. And therefore, Mr. Lipinski, given the research he had done, found it not to be an argument that he thought would be a winner on appeal. And he certainly raised other issues of merit. And as such, Mr. McDonald cannot show either prong of the Strickland analysis. In terms of the second argument regarding the...
you referred to the Strickland analysis, but both sides are arguing the application of Gray, which has a three-part analysis for the first prong of Strickland. Do you agree that's the proper analysis?
Yes.
For cases such as this?
Yes. As to the second argument regarding the alleged hearsay in Detective Mark Daniels' 3507 testimony regarding the statement of Ms. Wright, the court had previously ruled that state-of-mind evidence was coming in, and defense counsel objected to the court's ruling under 803.3 state-of-mind exception, allowing Spencer's statements to be admitted. That's on the record. There does not seem to be any issue in terms of that. Therefore, counsel's performance certainly was adequate. Moreover, because the court had found that this state-of-mind evidence was coming in and Ms. Wright testified about the incident and described Spencer as being scared, the fact that Mark Daniels repeated that same information is really of no moment.
As I understand Mr. Bernstein's point, it's a question of timing and whether it would come in during the case in chief by the state or whether it would come in rebuttal.
This was, first of all, was not hearsay. This was just generally information about Ms. Wright was recounting an incident that was establishing a relationship. It was near the time period of the murder. And as such, she was describing an incident that she witnessed, and it was her description of the victim as scared. She was asked what was her demeanor. She was scared. That is certainly relevant in the state's case in chief to set the scene, to establish the relationship between the people, and there's nothing untoward about that. There was also, in the third argument, complaint that defense counsel was ineffective by eliciting testimony concerning Julie Spencer's fear of Mr. McDonald. However, there had already been testimony to that effect from Ms. Wright. Also, it was a strategic decision to shut, because that information was used in closing by defense counsel to show that Julie Spencer would not have gone to meet Mr. McDonald if she was scared. So either she wasn't scared of him or she would not have gone to meet him, which was consistent with her not being with Mr. McDonald at the time. Otherwise, it made no sense. So in that sense, there's no performance problem. That was certainly not unreasonable.
In any way go, or could it have been misused to go to the defendant's state of mind?
Well, since that information was already in, and the state of mind as to the victim had already been found to be appropriate, admissible in this case by the court, the defense really had no choice but to find ways to work around that. So in terms of defense counsel's position, they were aware that this, that state of mind was going to come in, and consequently, as often defense counsel will do, they wanted to elicit testimony themselves and try and spin it their way rather than have it the state spin it their way. It's a strategic trial strategy that is often employed. If there is prejudicial information, often you want to get it out yourself rather than have the opposing counsel bring it out. That way it can be dealt with in a better manner. There's also a complaint by Mr. McDonald that his counsel failed to call certain witnesses. Now, Mr. Davis, who had testified at the first trial, was in his 70s, and the same information, basically, about seeing Mr. McDonald in his garage had also come in through Mr. Wiley, who was a state's witness, and therefore was quite useful to the defense that a state's witness was also saying that Mr. McDonald was at his garage in that time frame. Mr. Davis could not pinpoint exactly why. He knew that on that particular day he remembered that Mr. McDonald was there, so his testimony was perhaps not as strong, and it was certainly a valid decision not to call a witness when someone else was already going to provide that information. Also, the other witness, a defense witness, Ms. Prawl, was a younger woman, and she also testified, and she had a specific reason for remembering that date, which made her testimony more credible than that of Mr. Davis. The testimony of Wendy Mazza, based on the interview transcript with Mr. Benson, shows that Ms. Mazza would have testified that she saw bruises on Al Smith's legs, across his shoulders and arms on the Wednesday after Julie Spencer disappeared. Given the ME's testimony that Ms. Spencer was strangled probably from behind and forced down onto the ground, the bruising would not have corresponded to the presentation of evidence as to how Ms. Spencer was killed. Also, Mr. Smith was a large person. Ms. Spencer is small. It would not be credible that in a case where it did not appear there was any struggle, this small woman would have inflicted bruising all over Mr. Smith. Other parts of her interview involved her recitation of statements made by Mr. Smith, which would not have been admissible at trial in any case. They were hearsay. As such, she would not have been particularly helpful to the defense, and it was a valid strategic decision not to call her as a witness, as apparently that decision had also been made in the first trial as well. Finally, as to Mr. McDonald's allegations that he was not adequately prepared to testify and that he received bad advice. First, it's noteworthy that the post-conviction hearing regarding this was conducted some 12 years after the event, and memories fade. What is clear is that both defense counsel spent a lot of time with Mr. McDonald in preparation for his trial. Mr. McDonald agreed that he was prepped to testify, and that Mr. Gabe, who was opposed to having him testify, conducted the cross. In an earlier post-conviction hearing regarding related charges in 1997, there was Mr. Gabe testified that he conducted the cross about Mr. McDonald's inconsistent statement, prior inconsistent statements. In light of that, it would appear that Mr. McDonald either misunderstood the advice he was being given or at this late date things have been confused. Most likely, given the fact that the defense attorneys were perfectly well aware that his prior statements after waiving Miranda and pre-arrest statements certainly could be used against him on the stand. And their objection arose when there was any reference to, or what they thought was a reference to, the first trial. That's entirely consistent with the, well, what if she asked me this question? That question would be, why didn't you testify at the first trial? Not, why did you make inconsistent statements? And in light of that, the state contends, first of all, that
it is... Did the Superior Court make factual findings on that?
No. No, this, the ruling was that, well, there was, one moment. Well, the Superior Court found that they had put, that defense counsel had put in a large effort and that they had differing opinions and that ultimately it was his decision and that there was, Mr. Capone, it just says that he was allegedly received from Mr. Capone advice. So the court did not find that Mr. Capone, in fact, gave him that advice that he is complaining about now. In light of that, and in light of Mr. McDonald's agreement that he certainly was crossed in practice by Mr. Gabay, and Mr. Gabay being a very experienced defense counsel, certainly would have done a prep on that particular thing. And the fact that they can't remember that 12 years later, precisely which questions were asked or what advice was given, is not overly surprising. In any case, it was ultimately Mr. McDonald's decision to make. It is uncontested that the two counsel, his two defense counsel, had differing opinions, and as such, Mr. McDonald had to make that decision himself. And if, unfortunately for him, it didn't go too well for him, as Mr. Gabay had predicted, and he cannot now complain about his attorney's advice.
Were both of those opinions within the wide range of professional competence, or
certainly
one of them necessarily ineffective?
Well, no, because Mr. Gabay felt that Mr. McDonald would make a poor witness in part because of his demeanor. And on the other hand, Mr. Capone was looking well. Mr. McDonald did not testify at his first trial, and the rumor was that the decision had been 11-1 against him, so maybe something drastically different needed to be done. Those were both within, certainly within the wide range of professional behaviors.
But if the reason why one of the attorneys thought it would be okay for him to testify was because that attorney had a mistaken understanding of the law, apparently, with respect to whether it could be cross-examined on prior statements, wouldn't that be significant?
It would, but that is, in fact, sort of belied by the record. If that was what Mr. Capone truly believed, then he would have stood up and objected when the first question about prior inconsistent statements arose. And there was no such objection, which would lead you to believe that Mr. Capone knew that those would be a subject.
Either that or he made two mistakes.
That is a possibility, an unlikely one given his experience and the vigorous argument he made concerning the Doyle issue when there was some question about whether there was a reference to the first trial.
So are we to understand that the trial court basically decided that Mr. Capone hadn't given the advice that Mr. McDonald said he did?
Well, the Superior Court did say that they didn't believe that the advice extended to inconsistent pre-arrest statements, notwithstanding Mr. Capone's hazy recollection to the contrary. So the Superior Court certainly found Mr. Capone more credible on that issue.
Thank you.
What I'd like to do is spend my rebuttal time talking about the testify or not testify decision. The claim here is not that the lawyers were ineffective in advising Mr. McDonald to testify or not testify. That's not the claim. The claim is that Mr. McDonald looked to his lawyers for advice about a very specific concern that he had about being cross-examined about his prior inconsistent statements, and he got bad advice about that. And if the court, if I can refer the court to this court's decision in McDonald's direct appeal from a second conviction, and the site there is 816-82750. There's a very lengthy quote at page 31 of the appellant's opening brief, and it's very clear from the court's own decision that the Doyle issue was being cross-examined about not implicating Al Smith. And that is what Mr. McDonald was concerned about. That was the advice was, don't worry, we'll object. And that mistaken belief carried through to the appeal, because that was one of the issues.
So tell us what your understanding on the law is and what the bad advice was.
Well, the law, as I understand it, is that if a defendant takes the stand and what the court calls, I think, casts aside the cloak of privilege not to testify, that he can be cross-examined about prior inconsistent statements. And I think the quotation from this court's decision and McDonald's direct appeal, which appears at page 31 of our brief, is a correct statement of the law. Not arguing with that. What was wrong was the trial attorneys gave him an incorrect statement of the law.
Didn't the trial or the Superior Court on post-conviction review say it appears that the state's version of what took place is correct? The advice was so limited, and is referring to Mr. Capone's advice was limited to questions by the state as to why the defendant did not testify at his first trial.
Well, I'm going to disagree with that because I wasn't there, but I'm going to disagree with that because if you look at the...
Is that what the Superior Court said?
Yes, that's what the Superior Court said. And I disagree with that because if you look at this court's own analysis of what was argued on appeal, what was argued on appeal was McDonald should not have been cross-examined about his prior inconsistent statements. And I'm going to read from the court's decision here, the questioning on cross-examination was framed in the context of the defendant's pre-arrest statements to the police. Gave several pre-arrest statements, and when confronted with the fact that the victim had been murdered, he failed to implicate Smith. And that was what, on appeal, was objected to.
Was that argued to the trial court here?
It was argued to the trial court in the sense that we argued that the advice had to do with being cross-examined about not implicating Al Smith when he talked to the police. The trial court in this proceeding parsed that down to, well, he was really only talking about being cross-examined about why didn't you testify at the first trial, which clearly would have been objectionable.
But he did that after considering what you're arguing to us now.
I believe so, yeah. First, I can produce the briefs we filed at the trial court. That was our argument. It wasn't limited to questions that were never asked. Why didn't you testify at the first trial? It was never asked on cross-examination. So there was no even an opportunity to object to that. But what was objected to was ultimately this Doyle issue that failed.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take the matter under advisement and we'll adjourn.
Thanks, bye.